The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
So in May of this year, we celebrated the 200th birthday of Karl Marx.
Or at least,
woo! Most of us here celebrated, but you gotta give the man credit because love him or hate him, everybody still has something to say about him 200 years later. But you know, reading the coverage at the time, I was actually amazed at how positive it was. The New York Times ran an editorial saying Karl Marx was right. Teen Vogue, which I understand is also here covering this conference, which is amazing. They wrote up a great overview of Marx's ideas. And even billionaire Elon Musk claims to be all into Marx these days. Although it's not clear he's actually read Marx, he most definitely skimmed the Wikipedia article. But if he were really a Marxist, he would take the advice given to him by Haymarket Books and hand over his factories to his workers and launch himself into space. Bon voyage, comrade. So clearly then, Marx's ideas remain hugely relevant, which is not something that most 200-year-old authors can say. But what I hope this talk can help to answer is why. Was it just that he's some sort of genius? Did he have a time machine or something? And while he was clearly a brilliant guy, I think Marx himself would reject this as an explanation for why he came to his ideas and why they remain relevant. So in this talk, I hope to give a Marxist approach, take a Marxist approach, if you will, to understanding Marx himself. And I know I just blew your minds right there, so I'll let that sink in. So I'm not sure who came up with the title for this talk, but I like it a lot because I think it touches on a couple important insights. First, that Marx didn't start off as a revolutionary. In fact, nobody does. Anyone here born a revolutionary? Okay, didn't think so. But you can imagine any number of people, for instance, who supported Bernie Sanders, say, describing themselves as extreme Democrats. And then some of those, through the course of their experience, and maybe meeting people like ourselves, ending up as revolutionaries. And of course, in modern day America, Democrat has a specific meaning, which is support for the Democratic Party, which ironically enough is not particularly democratic. But a lot of the time, when people say they're extremely democratic or extremely liberal, what they mean is they're on the furthest left end of the extremely stunted political spectrum in mainstream US politics. And in a way, I think this relates to the sort of transformation that Marx made himself as he came up against the limits of the existing democratic politics of his time and realized he needed to go further. And understanding this evolution is also important because it touches on the more general question of the relationship between democracy and socialism, which is still very much a live question we grapple with today. So before I get into all of that, just to say, this talk is not going to be an exhaustive biography of Marx or a full explication of all of his ideas. In fact, I'm going to pretty narrowly focus on the early years. And in his first volume of The Revolutionary Ideas of Karl Marx, Hal Draper, which these books look intimidating, they're really excellent, and they double as a weapon, so but in it, Hal Draper actually claims that the period when Marx went from extreme Democrat to revolutionary was really short, basically from the beginning to the end of the year 1842. I'm going to cover a little bit wider period of that, hopefully getting up through 1845 or so, which seems like a short time frame, but I'm really only going to scratch the surface. So let's get into it. So Marx was born in 1818 in the town of Trier, which is now in Germany, but at the time was a bunch of small kingdoms loosely ruled over by the King of Prussia. And in fact, the area that Marx was from, called the Rhineland, had been occupied by the French under Napoleon up until 3 years before Marx was born. And as a result of the revolution, the French Revolution, the French had instituted more liberal laws and laid the basis for more advanced industry than in the rest of Germany. And this is an important context, because it meant that there was still a fair amount of sentiment in the area for the ideals of the French Revolution, such as democratic rights and freedom of the press, and a rising capitalist class that began to clash with the feudal power of the Prussian monarchy. Now, it should be said that these champions of liberty were a pretty timid bunch, but that didn't apparently make them any less of a threat. In fact, Marx's father was part of this crowd, perhaps in part due to the fact that the Prussian government implemented anti-Jewish laws, which meant he had to convert to Christianity in order to enter his chosen field as a lawyer. And Heinrich Marx was no radical, But he participated in some of these liberal meetings, and at one such gathering, he gave a speech actually praising the king for listening to the wishes of his subjects by allowing the Diet or provincial assembly to meet. But as Mary Gabriel wrote, quote, while his speech was sincere, it was interpreted as ironic and raised alarms among government officials. The club was put under surveillance and Heinrich Mark regarded with suspicion by the government. So these no doubt made some impression on Marx, as did his relationship with his future father-in-law, Ludwig von Westphalen, who exposed him to the ideas of utopian socialists such as Saint-Simon. But despite these somewhat radical influences, Marx grew up in a comfortable middle-class household, and when he went off to college, seemed destined to become a lawyer or some other professional, respectable professional like his father. But fortunately for us, this was not to be. So in college, Marx began his lifelong habits of drinking too much and spending beyond his means, but he also got hooked on an even more dangerous drug, philosophy. In particular, he came around a group known as the Young Hegelians, so named after one of the most important German philosophers of the time, Hegel. And to be honest, I wasn't super excited to have to read Hegel for this talk. Lenin once said that reading Hegel was the best way to get a headache, and I can now confirm that is accurate. But I will say it's worthwhile to get your head around Hegel's ideas because they're profoundly important to how Marx came to his own analysis of the world. And I'd highly recommend, for an accessible introduction, Todd Cretian gave a talk that's on We Are Many on Hegel's influence on Marx. So a key concept that Hegel developed was dialectics. And this is a word that sounds scary and is misused all the time, but it's actually not all that hard to grasp. So the basic idea is that everything is always changing and change happens through contradiction, that is the clash of opposing forces. And along this you have the concepts of transformation of quantity into quality and the negation of the negation. And there's some useful sort of examples from nature that illustrate this. For instance, the famous one that Hegel gave is of a bud becoming a flower and then a fruit. And at each stage, it seems that the new form negates the previous one, but they're actually part of one continuous process. And to understand the truth of the whole plant, you have to understand all of these different stages as part of a unified whole. Likewise, you can think about boiling a pot of water. As the temperature increases little by little, it can look like nothing's happening until it reaches the crucial point, and then you have steam. So quantity becomes quality. And Hegel's own ideas about the world were profoundly influenced by the French Revolution, which showed in practice how the contradictions within a society, which may have been long simmering under the surface, can burst forth in a transformative event, which produces a new type of society, but which nonetheless grew out of the contradictions of the old one. But to Hegel, this process was fundamentally one of ideas. Thus, he saw society progressing through a series of stages in which the mind, or absolute spirit, became increasingly conscious of itself. I know, this is where he starts to lose me too. He also concluded that this process had now reached an end, as the state had found its most perfect expression in the Prussian monarchy. You know, the ones who were afraid of ironic speeches. So this is one clue that by the time he died in 1831, Hegel had become somewhat more conservative. But the new crop of his young disciples were eager to press his ideas in more radical directions. One particular focus was the attack on religion, which they believed blinded humanity to the truth about the world. And given the generally repressive atmosphere, they may have thought that this critique was safe, because it wasn't directly about politics. In fact, they're pretty much the annoying militant atheists we've all encountered, who will debate you endlessly about how the Bible is illogical, but don't actually do anything at all. Personally, I'll take a Christian civil rights crusader any day of the week. But since Prussia was officially a Christian state and they used religion to justify their rule, they actually did see this as a threat and began passing up young Hegelians for posts and promotions in the universities. So this is how our young Marx found himself at graduation, overeducated and with no good job prospects. I'm sure none of you here can relate. And this is how he ended up taking a job as a journalist, eventually becoming editor of a newspaper called the Rheinische Zeitung, probably saying that wrong. And as Marx later put it, it was working as a journalist that he, quote, first found myself in the embarrassing position of having to discuss what is known as material interests. It's a tough blow for a philosophy major. And two of the most notable topics he wrote about were on free speech and wood theft. And it's important to point out that this newspaper was funded and meant to represent the interests of the capitalist class in the Rhineland. And they were in favor of increased democratic freedoms in the same way that capitalists are today, to the extent that it's good for business. And in the context of a feudal monarchy, this obviously did make them more radical. But this still had limits. They weren't necessarily that interested in the free speech of people who worked for them, for instance. In fact, they were afraid of it. But at the time, Marx was very solidly in favor of their program, that is, the advancement of democratic rights alongside private industry. But his theoretical approach to the question of democracy caused him to take it to an extreme, if you will, that he didn't yet fully grasp the implications of. So in this period, you can still, in some of these writings, you can still see the influence of Hegel. For instance, when Marx contrasts democracy as it actually exists to an ideal form, or what he called true democracy. But it's important to note that Marx actually engaged in these debates concretely, unlike many of his fellow young Hegelians who saw politics as something beneath them and preferred to live in the world of pure ideas. And you can almost hear similar arguments today when people are like, who cares about defending voting rights or free speech when we know that the whole thing's corrupt, right? Like, let's just talk about that. Now, granted, Marx had somewhat of a vested interest in the censorship question, being that he worked for a newspaper, but his commitment to democratic politics continued even as he began to break with the limitations of both bourgeois democracy and Hegelian idealism. As Draper put it, quote, "Marx was the first socialist figure to come to an acceptance of the socialist idea through the battle for consistent extension of democratic control from below. He was the first figure in the socialist movement who, in a personal sense, came through the bourgeois democratic movement, through it to its further bounds, and then out by its farthest end. In this sense, he was the first to fuse the struggle for consistent political democracy with the struggle for socialist transformation." So the second major topic that Marx wrote about was on the question of wood theft, which was one of the first times he dealt more concretely with the questions of poverty and inequality. To give some background, for centuries, it had been the practice of poor peasants to collect fallen wood in the forest to use for heat. However, when the timber industry began to take off and wood became a profitable commodity, this act was now classified as a theft. And to give a sense of the scope of this issue, in the area around Marx's hometown of Trier, fully 97% of all theft prosecutions were for wood theft. So Marx puts forward, in my opinion, a rather convoluted legalistic argument against the law, but a few things stand out in these articles that presage his later development. First, he brings out the contradiction between the state, which theoretically represents the collective will of all society, and that of private interest, in which individuals only look out for their own personal gain. And Marx is quite clear that his sympathies lie with the poor, who are forced to suffer because of these laws, and he's outraged by the callousness of those who seek to profit at their expense. And you can see the germ of some of his critiques of capitalism in this passage, for instance. Quote, "Cruelty is a characteristic feature of laws dictated by cowardice, for cowardice can be energetic only by being cruel. Private interest, however, is always cowardly, for its heart, its soul, is an external object which can always be wrenched away and injured, and who has not trembled at the danger of losing heart and soul? How could the selfish legislator be human when something inhuman, an alien material essence, is his supreme essence?" So, due to articles like these, no doubt, Marx finally lost his battle with the censors and resigned from the newspaper when it became clear that the capitalist backers were prepared to cave to the censors rather than fight back. And at this point, Marx really started to work through in theory what he had started to learn and experience in practice. In particular, he took on Hegel's idea that the state existed as some sort of neutral body floating above the classes and regulating their interests, which of course is still what most liberals and mainstream politicians believe to this day. But what Marx came to realize was that while formal freedom and democracy could exist in such a society, they would inevitably be subverted in the interests of those who controlled society's wealth. Real freedom was impossible in a society divided into exploiters and exploited. And what was needed was not formal equality before the law, but a genuine equality in which economic power was not in the hands of a privileged minority. What was needed, in other words, was the abolition of private property. So Marx became a communist because of his commitment to radical democracy and human liberation. As he and Engels put it a few years later, quote, "We're not among those communists who are out to destroy personal liberty, who wish to turn the world into one huge barrack or into a gigantic workhouse. We have no desire to exchange freedom for equality. We are convinced that in no social order will personal freedom be so assured as in a society based on communal ownership. And here's an important thing to keep in mind. Marx did not invent communism. It was, in fact, a very growing and popular conception at that time, communism, socialism, used often interchangeably. But of course, it meant very many different things to many people. And while Marx was generally won over to the need for some kind of communism, at this time he was still skeptical of the socialists and communists he came across in Germany, who were mostly of the utopian variety, i.e. focused on laying out detailed plans for an ideal social future society without any idea of how to get there. But Marx himself was still unclear on how to get there. All of that changed, though, decisively in 1843 when he moved to Paris and came in contact with the workers' movement for the first time. And here I really want to put in a plug for this book, The Theory of Revolution and the Young Marx. It's really a brilliant explication of all the themes I try to cover in this talk and more. Everyone should check this out. And I think in particular it really makes clear the impact that Marx's interaction with the workers' movement made on his ideas. So whereas before arriving in Paris, Marx definitely had some sympathy for the plight of the working class, he saw them mainly as a suffering class. One that could be rescued, perhaps with the help of him and his fellow intellectuals. But in Paris, he encountered an active class, a class that had already begun to adopt communist ideas on its own. And I'll quote just a little bit. This is one of his footnotes. So, the year 1840 saw the first independent and public manifestation of the Communist Party. It was in 1842 that the Society of Egalitarian Workers was formed, made up exclusively of workers and with a clearly communist program. In 1840, furthermore, a real general strike took place in Paris, the ringleaders of which seemed to have been inspired by communist ideas. According to an agent provocateur who had infiltrated the secret societies, quote, about 1840, Paris began to be seriously infected by communism. Bourgeois liberal writers observed with alarm in 1841 that although only a few years ago insurrections took place in the name of the Republic, today their slogan is common ownership of property. And democratic publicists such as Thor claimed that nearly all the workers in Paris, Lyon, Rouen, etc. adhere more or less to the sect of communists or egalitarians. So Marx enthusiastically leapt into making contact with these groups upon arriving in Paris. And a few other important things happened in this time period. The first was he made contact with Frederick Engels, marking the beginning of an epic bromance that would last the rest of their lives. And just a quick shout out for Engels, who I think doesn't get nearly as much credit as he deserves. And this talk was built about being about Marx, so I've been focusing on him so far, but really you should assume from here on out that all of their work was a joint collaboration in which Engels made no small contribution. In fact, it was Engels who first introduced Marx to the classical British economists as well as the working class movement in England. And although Engels was also German, his father was a wealthy industrialist who owned textile mills in Manchester. And it was there that Engels first discovered an industrial capitalism much further in advance than that of Germany or even France. In his book, The Condition of the Working Class in England provides both a searing indictment of the horrific working and living conditions of English factory workers, combined with an analysis of how this misery was directly connected with the profits of the capitalist class. He also made contact with the leaders of the Chartist movement, who he had later introduced to Marx, which organized workers not just around workplace, but also political demands, including universal suffrage. And just to give one other shout out to a woman named Mary Burns, who Engels met in Manchester and remained his partner until her death. And Burns was a factory worker, a revolutionary socialist, and an Irish nationalist. And it was really because of her that Engels was introduced to both the conditions of the English working class and their revolutionary organizations. So she really played a pivotal role in this whole development and doesn't get nearly enough or any credit a lot of the time. Another significant event in this period was the revolt of the Silesian weavers in Marx's home country of Germany. This wave of strikes and riots spread across the region throughout the summer of 1844 before finally being put down by armed soldiers. And while some critics dismiss this as wild rioting, Marx pointed out that the weavers not only destroyed the machines of the capitalists, but, quote, also the account books, the titles of ownership. And whereas all other movements had directed their attacks primarily at the visible enemy, namely the industrialists, the Silesian workers turned also against a hidden enemy, the bankers. And while he may have been guilty of slightly over-exaggerating the significance of this particular revolt, for Marx, it's still confirmed for him that despite their relatively small number at the time, the working class represented the future in Germany, as in the rest of Europe. And here again, I want to quote one of my favorite parts from this book. And again, it's a footnote, so moral is definitely don't skip the footnotes. And this is from a Silesian railway worker who was interviewed shortly after the weavers revolted. And if you pay attention to this quote, I think you can hear the answer to the question Marx and Engels raised in their third thesis on Feuerbach, in which they challenged the idea held by many of the utopian socialists that workers must be properly educated before they become fit to run society. But in response, Marx and Engels asked, but who educates the educator? So here's the answer given by a Silesian railway worker. Quote, so long as we work here, we make a living for ourselves. But we know very well that we're being skinned, mainly for the financier's benefit. They are in the town, in the marketplace, and they're doing well off of our sweat. We shall be the last to use the trains that we build. Our only advantage is that, huddled together in thousands, we've got to know each other. And through our long mutual relation, most of us have grown more intelligent. Only a few of us now believe the old fables. We now have devil of a bit of respect for the eminent and the rich. What people hardly dared to think silently at home, we now say aloud. It is we who maintain the rich, and it would be enough for us to will it, for them to beg for their bread from us, or else die of hunger if they are not willing to work. Believe me, if the weavers had resisted longer, there would have been trouble among us. The weavers' business is, at bottom, our business too. And as we are 20,000 men working in the trains in Silesia, we should have had something to say about it as well. I think this quote is proof that you don't have to be a philosophy major to explain dialectics. But at the same time, it was precisely because Marx had developed a dialectical method through studying Hegel that he was able to see the seeds of potential transformation in this struggle that most others at the time ignored. And in this period, Marx and Engels wrote a number of important works that began to tie together these various experiences and form a coherent theory of social change. One was the thesis on Feuerbach, which I just mentioned. And Feuerbach was another young Hegelian philosopher who was hugely influential on Marx, especially his materialist analysis of religion. However, Feuerbach's materialism was one-sided, seeing human beings as merely products of their circumstances and leaving no room for human agency. Instead, Marx and Engels argued that human activity is itself both a part of the material world, but it also actively shapes it. And the point of theory, therefore, is as a guide to human action. As they famously put it in the 11th thesis, quote, philosophies have merely interpreted the world in various ways. The point is to change it. Another important thing that Marx wrote at this time were the Economic and Philosophical Manuscripts of 1844. And this was Marx's really first attempt to flesh out some of his economic analysis of class society through a study of the British economists. The manuscripts contain a moving indictment of capitalism's impact on the human spirit by alienating us from the products of our labor, from our fellow human beings, and from our own nature. And there's much more to say about this. Luckily, there's a talk on alienation later in the conference, which I highly encourage folks to check out. And then in 1845, Marx and Engels write The German Ideology, in which they pull together all these threads and lay out their theory of working class revolution. And I'm going to spend a little more time going through this because I think in many ways it was the first Marxist book that they wrote. Losing my voice. So in The German Ideology, Marx and Engels take Hegel's ideas about human society progressing through stages driven by their own internal contradictions, but turn it upside down. So instead of ideas, the starting point for understanding human society is how people go about producing their means of subsistence. As they put it, quote, life is not determined by consciousness, but consciousness by life. In other words, all the ideas and ideologies that arise to explain why things are the way they are ultimately shaped by the underlying economic structures. And furthermore, that in a class society, the dominant ideas will be those of the ruling class, because they have not only a vested interest in justifying the current state of affairs, but also the power and the means to disseminate those justifications. Now, there can be ideas that challenge those justifications, but the existence of those ideas, quote, presupposes the existence of a revolutionary class. And in the case of the French Revolution, these were the ideas of the rising bourgeoisie or capitalist class, who in the course of the revolution put forward their own ideas as the universal interests of all humanity. But the bourgeoisie ultimately represented only a minority class, and once their political power was consolidated, or before it was in the case of Germany, they used it to maintain their exploitation of the proletariat or working class, thus inevitably leading to a new conflict between these two classes. But they argued the working class is different because they have no property and hence no specific interest to defend apart from the whole of humanity. Therefore, Marx and Engels saw the working class as a universal class, or a class with radical chains, whose revolution would do away with the need for classes altogether and usher in a communist society. Finally, they emphasized that communism can only come about through the self-emancipation of the working class. And here I think you can really see the importance of Hegel's dialectics in understanding revolution as a transformative process and not simply a means to an end. So they write, quote, "Both for the production on a mass scale of this communist consciousness and for the success of the cause itself, the alteration of men, women, people, on a mass scale is necessary, an alteration which can only take place in a practical movement, a revolution. This revolution is necessary, therefore, not only because the ruling class cannot be overthrown in any other way, but also because the class overthrowing it can only in a revolution succeed in ridding itself of all the muck of ages and become fitted to found society anew." So the German ideology itself was never published at the time. In fact, it wasn't published till the 1930s and not in English till the 1960s. But its authors weren't concerned about this at the time because their main point was to try to clarify things for themselves so they could get to work. As Engels reflected many years later, quote, "Now we are by no means of the opinion that the new scientific results should be confided in large tomes, exclusively to the learned world. Quite the contrary, we are both of us already deeply involved in the political movement and possessed a certain following in the educated world, as well as abundant contact with the organized proletariat. It was our duty to provide a scientific foundation for our view, but it was equally important for us to win over the European and, in the first place, the German proletariat to our conviction. So as soon as we had become clear in our own minds, we set about the task." And at this point, Marx and Engels had ceased to be merely theorists and were active participants in attempting to build the beginnings of a revolutionary workers' movement. This doesn't mean they neglected theory. Most of the themes developed in the German ideology were repeated in more precise and accessible form in the Communist Manifesto of 1848, which was published on the eve of the great revolutions that swept Europe that same year. So obviously, this is far from the end of the story, although I'm needing to wrap up. But Marx and Engels continue to develop upon, refine, and even alter their theories throughout their lives. It wasn't till years later, after all, that Marx more fully fleshed out his theories of political economy and capital. And the experience of the revolutions of 1848, and importantly, the Paris Commune of 1871, which was the world's first workers' government, also forced them to reconsider their views on revolution and the state. And of course, their practical activism forced them to address the question of socialist organization. And the latter part of the Lowy book has a great discussion on that aspect. So this real history, I think, flies in the face of those who take Marxism as some sort of dogma, which includes both his detractors, but also many of his supposed followers, Stalinists. And as Marx, but in contrast, as Marx wrote early on in his path to becoming a revolutionary, quote, "We do not confront the world in a doctrinaire way with a new principle. Here is the truth. Kneel down before it. We develop new principles of the world out of the world's own principles. We do not say to the world, cease your struggles, they are foolish. We will give you the true slogan for the struggle. We merely show the world what it is really fighting for, and that consciousness is something it has to acquire, whether it wants to or not." So rather than providing us a blueprint or formula, Marxism provides us with a method for approaching the new questions that the world continues to throw up. The main contours of this method, which I think remain crucial for us today, are historical materialism, dialectics, and a commitment to the most extreme democracy there is, working class self-emancipation. And 200 years after his birth, these tools remain as vital as ever if we want to not only interpret the world, but to change it.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.